In any event, the Dharma Master sure is there, and he's asked me to cover while he's gone. And he wasn't exactly clear where he let off, or he wasn't sure where he let off. And so I'm going to start at the bottom of page 75. We're in the 10 grounds of the Mahavaikuntha Avatamsaka Sutra, the Dasharbhumi section, the 10 grounds section. And it's talking here about the Bodhisattva when he enters the state of the 10 grounds. It starts to describe his activities and his actions and what he does in seeking out knowledge of this ground. But primarily, we'll notice it's knowledge not just for himself, but to become a guide, a teacher for other living beings. You have to remember that everything about a bodhisattva is never about just the bodhisattva. Every thought, every consideration, every impulse is the idea of how can I help others? How can I benefit others? In fact, there is a stage that we're going to get to here where the bodhisattva has an enlightenment. And his enlightenment experience is that he sees, he doesn't think, he doesn't imagine, he actually sees, he says, that there is no difference between myself and all beings and all worlds. I am a single substance with all beings and all worlds. So this realization, this insight, you could call it vision, but it's really an insight into the nature of reality, that we are all of one. He sees or she sees us directly. And from that point on, everything changes. So at this point of the text, we're describing the bodhisattva's mastery of certain skills and abilities, all of which are aimed to preparing him to be a teacher. So we're going to start at this bodhisattva is good at knowing remedies. Now, probably Hung Shri went into this a little bit, or no?
Yes.
He just mentioned that the merchant leader was coming up, but he didn't say where the merchant leader session was coming up. So let's just overlap a little and we'll run into this. Okay, so slowly we'll do the Chinese up to, go right through to the next page. Slowly. Okay. In English, the text reads, this bodhisattva is good at knowing remedies for all obstructions to the grounds, knowing the accomplishments and destruction of the grounds, good at knowing marks and fruits of the grounds, good at knowing marks and fruits of the grounds, good at knowing the entertainment and cultivation of the grounds, good at knowing the purification of the dharmas of the grounds, good at knowing the practices in turn for each ground. Good at knowing the goals and does not hold for each ground. Good at knowing the spring vision of each ground. Good at knowing the reversibility of each ground. Good at knowing how to purify the regulations of the ground. Up to and including the ground and the rest of the So this bodhisattva isn't referring to any particular bodhisattva, it's referring to any bodhisattva, any enlightened being who enlightens others, who attains this level of self-cultivation. Skillful, good at knowing remedies for obstructions of the grounds, and also good at knowing the accomplishment or the attainment and the non-attainment. We can say destruction here, but what accomplishes and what doesn't accomplish in the grounds. In other words, what leads to success in one's cultivation and what doesn't. And this is very important to understand. Sometimes we take up practices or we have impulses that we think will lead to breakthroughs or to insights, but in fact, they don't. And sometimes the ones we most resist are the ones that can for us. So again, at the beginning, it's really important to have a teacher to point out not only what text to study, but what practices to take up that are best going to suit you to get you moving along the path. It's not for sure that what you like at the beginning is what's best for you. So again, he or she has this ability of knowing this. And the marks and the fruits, these are technical terms. Anybody know marks and fruits? This sounds really funny if you're not into Buddhist jargon, knowing the marks and the fruits. It sounds like you're looking at blemished fruit at the market or something. What are the marks? What does marks mean? What's the character here? Is it the xiang?
Xiang.
Let's see, where are we in text here? Yeah, xiang. First character, the second to last line. This is used, it's a technical term in Buddhism and in Chinese philosophy as well, but it means that which can be seen, that which has appearance. So they use mark. It could be characteristics. You could translate it that way too. The marks, the characteristics, the appearances, the outward manifestations of something. And then it's used interchangeably with wuxiang, which means without mark or markless. And so at the highest stage, there is no mark to the practice. There is no mark to the accomplishment. But at the beginning stages, moving along, there are things that characterize and one can distinguish, and he's good at knowing that. The fruits, this is a translation of wo. For the early disciples of my teacher, when we first took refuge, back 150 years ago, it was longer than that, probably. Yeah, I can't remember past 150. The names that we were given began with Guo. So when we took refuge as lay people, everybody's first new name was Guo. And then it could be Guo Shan, Guo Ting, Guo Er, and so on and so forth. So that meant literally fruit of then something. Okay? So it meant your name was given, you were the result. Your present situation was the fruit of the result of something else. Usually your second name indicated the meaning of the first part, which you were the result of. And so your ability to come forth and take refuge with the triple jewel, walking in the door in that way and kind of coming back, was the fruit. What was the seed? The seed was planted perhaps many lifetimes ago. So often my teacher would say, ah, you're back. And say, oh, you know, it's the first time I came. For our thought, it was the first time, but from his view, this was the return of something that had been planted many, many lifetimes ago. And we don't necessarily understand why we come or why we don't. And these are deeper things that are going on in our consciousness than we can think about. So the deeper motives or the deeper impulses that move us towards the way and sometimes away from the way are not things that we consciously think about. These have to do with deep seeds. He even wrote a song in English that says, I'm really lucky to study Buddhism. I won't sing it for you because you'd all definitely block up your ears with my singing. But the words are, I'm really lucky to study Buddhism because last life I planted good seeds. Now in this life, I've met good friends and a good knowing one to teach me deep wisdom. I think that I will go to Buddhahood real soon. My Dharma friends and I, together we will go to Buddhahood real soon. So you can put any melody you want to it. There's a melody that goes with it. But the principle was he was making a song for us in English that our luckiness of studying Buddhism was a result of having planted good seeds in the past that now bear fruit. So you can see Guo as having that realization of knowing and what are the accomplishments in terms of the fruition or the attainments or the realization of the grounds? Knowing the attainment and cultivation of the grounds, how they are actually brought about practice, knowing the purification of the dharmas of the ground. Purification generally refers to precepts, of course, but it has many, many different levels. There's the outward purification, where you formally are holding precepts with your body. But then there's the inner purification, where you're holding the precepts and it doesn't have an outward sign. You're holding them in your thoughts and your impulses and your feelings. This is probably the more important aspect of holding the precepts. It's not simply enough to be externally in conformance with the precepts of not killing, not stealing, and so forth. But more importantly, as all the great teachers teach, precepts have to be held in the mind ground, the dharmas of the ground, where dharma arises, it arises from the ground of the mind. Purification then has to take place in the most hidden of places. Even Confucius had an expression, he said, the superior person, the junzi, the cultivating person, at all times is mindful of his or her thoughts and feelings and conduct, even alone when nobody sees him or her. Their behavior and thoughts are no different than when they're with others. Even when they're alone in their own rooms, they never deviate from this when nobody can see them. And he goes on to say, if you cultivate in this way, even if you say nothing, your virtue is manifest, marked. You can see it. On the other hand, even if you don't cultivate in this way, no matter what you say, it will fall apart and won't stand up. So he said, that which is most hidden is most manifest. The inner, which is most hidden, is the thing that is most manifest on the outside. This is the power, he says, of virtue that comes from this. So, good at knowing the practices in turn for each ground, good at knowing what holds and does not hold for each ground. Each one of these different grounds, the 10 grounds, have different characteristics, different qualifications, different things that apply, and different stages of awakening. Different stages of awakening. The text often says awakening accumulates. Awakening isn't this stroke that comes at one moment, but it comes in many degrees and many forms. And this is a progressive awakening, a progressive brightening. Remember the previous passage we had of just like gold that is continually put back into smelting? This is again another metaphor that's used to say that you reach one stage of awakening and that gives you the solidity now to move to the next stage. And once you're at the next stage, it gives you even more brightness to begin to see the possibilities of moving on to the next stage. You can see this teaching is really at the heart of Buddhism. In psychology, it's called shaping. Shaping. You familiar with that term? Some people know what shaping is. What's shaping? I see you nodding your head. Or are you just trying to keep warm? It's a form of conditioning or training or learning where you take a very, very difficult task and you break it down into a series of smaller tasks. Each one, when you master it, builds up so that you can do the next one. Okay, for example, you want to ride your bike no hands. Okay, well, you want to ride your bike no hands and you're 4 years old. And so what you tell the child is get on the big 12 speed and go down the steep hill with no hands. No, you don't do that. First, you get them a tricycle, right? And they can ride the tricycle and they feel pretty good about that. Then you get them a little two-wheeler with the, what do you call those, training wheels, right? And then they ride that and they feel it's a little bigger, but they're not afraid. And then you gradually raise the training wheels a little bit off the ground so that if they go to one side, it still catches them. And they start to learn balance and gradually you can raise them higher and higher and higher. And pretty soon you can take off the training wheels. And now they can ride without training wheels. And eventually, by building up these skills and balance, they can get to the point that they ride no-handed. Okay? I'm just giving a very sort of simple metaphor for this. In the same way of cultivation, you'll see in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha uses shaping. Now, the Buddha did not study psychology formally, as far as I know it. But Buddhism is psychology. Buddhism is the teaching of the mind in all its states. It's nothing more than the discovery and the exploration and the liberation of the mind to its fullest capacity. So in one sense, you could say it's the utmost of psychology. And so the Buddha realized with his disciples that they were all coming in at different levels of interest and different levels of abilities. So he shaped a pattern for them to follow. He gave them things that were fairly easy but a little difficult to do. And once they mastered that, then he would give them another one and another one, never letting them go too far ahead of themselves lest they lose faith and they get discouraged, but never letting them get lax so they would become self-complacent and fall behind. This is the art of really good teaching. And it's based on this key concept in Buddhism called upaya, or fangbian. Right? You know about this. So that all the teachings, the Buddha said, all my teachings are training wheels. That's not exactly what he said. All my teachings are upaya, fangbian. They're expedients. Once you learn the art of doing this, you no longer need the training wheels. And once you learn my dharma, you no longer need my dharma. And this is the famous parable of the raft, where the Buddha said, my teaching is this raft that you put together to go from one shore to another. Once you're on the other shore, you no longer need the raft. Don't fondle and crave and caress my teaching in this way and say, now I have the dharma, or you miss the point. The other analogy the Buddha gave is what for this upaya? Anybody? The finger in the moon is a famous Zen story that illustrates the principle of this. Who said that? Somebody. Oh, you said it. You know, what is the story of the finger in the moon? If you look really closely, you'll see there's a finger in the moon. I'm just saying this facetiously because when you grow up in the West, you see the man in the moon. Right, so when I was a little boy, my grandfather took me out and he said, you want to see the man in the moon? I thought, is he scary? No, he's really nice. So my grandfather took his thing and he said, now look off the end of the finger. There's the moon, and you see there's his eyes and his mouth. And so I saw the man in the moon. So every time it was a full moon, I thought of my grandfather pointing to the finger in the moon. Then when I was a monk, there was a monk from Asia, we were walking at night and it was full moon night. He says, hey, look at the rabbit in the moon. I said, what? There's a man in the moon. He says, what are you talking about? There's a rabbit in the moon. So apparently in his side, it's the rabbit in the moon. And so we sat there for a long time. This sounds like something out of the Sixth Patriarch. You know, is there a rabbit in the moon or is the man in the moon? And the patriarch would say, there's no moon. It's all you. But in any event, we're looking. And finally, he shows me how the ears are brought back. You know, and he does this whole thing. And finally, I can see the rabbit in the moon. So depending on your point of view, there's either a rabbit or a man. Now tonight there's enough of a full moon so you go out, you can see. So when the cops stop you, say, I'm looking for the rabbit. And in Berkeley they won't pay any attention, it's fine. So, but the story is, what? With the finger in the moon. This is a famous Chan story. Right. So the Buddha is saying, to see the moon, to show the moon to someone, you take your finger and you point to the moon. But the fingertip is not the moon. It's merely pointing to the moon. If you mistake the end of the fingertip for the moon, you'll never see the moon. In the same way, my teaching is the moon. And the various dharmas I give are pointing to that. But if you cling to the tip of the finger, by clinging to the teachings, you'll never see the moon. You'll only see the tip of the finger and mistake it for the moon. And it's as foolish as the person who cannot or will not let go of the finger. You know, I say, there's no moon unless I do this. So it's again another metaphor the Buddha's using for the expedient teaching. So the shaping technique the Buddha uses, you'll see this through all the dharmas. And finally, at the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the famous last teaching of the Buddha, they ask him for the final finger, in a way. Like, you're about to leave, Buddha, so give us the final finger so we can really hold on to it. And the Buddha said, I have no teaching. I have nothing to give you. Life and death are a great matter. You better work on this quickly and get this solved. And he pulled the rug out. He did not want to give a final teaching that they would then etch on stone and make permanent, because it was like he's saying, mistaking the finger for the moon, and now you go and say, you know, this is what points to the moon. This is I. Someday this is going to, you know, and you mistake it, you never see the moon. So his final teaching was to say, I have no teaching. I gave you no teaching. I merely gave you expedience to break your attachments. If you cling to it, that's another form of attachment. Therefore, you'll never see the moon, or you'll never make the breakthrough. So every teaching that the Buddha has set up by design was set up to be a finger pointing to the moon. Once you see the moon, you can dispense with the finger. Not literally, but figuratively. Okay. So this shaping technique, though, the Buddha used, you also see it in the famous Lotus Sutra, where the Buddha expediently leads his disciples in a series of stages that sometimes are called carts or vehicles. And so he leads them to the Arhat vehicle, the Pratyeka Buddha vehicle, to the Bodhisattva vehicle, each time. And it's compared to this journey where they're going on this long destination. And each time they want to camp and stop, the Buddha says, well, this is good, you can stay here. But right above the next hill, there's even a sweeter place. And so they all pack up again and they go on. And of course, they do get there and it's sweeter, and then they think, this is it, let's rest here. The Buddha says, this is nice, but it still isn't as good as. And so by shaping and leading them along, they finally get to what's called the one vehicle, the Buddha vehicle. And this one cart or one vehicle is no cart and no vehicle. It's no attachment. This is the Buddha state. So the shaping technique is used both in the grounds, stages of 10 grounds, progressively leading higher. This in the Avatamsaka, stages of 10 are used throughout. But this is a very, very good shaping technique. Okay, any questions on... You know what's really interesting too, if you look at this, and tonight I'm going to use fingers pointing to the moon. I'm in that mood because somebody gave me a new storybook on Buddhism and that and brought up all kinds of stories in my mind. So I'm going to do some stories tonight, which are fingers pointing to the moon, or parables. Parable literally means, from the Greek, to throw something down alongside something else to make a comparison. So analogies and parables are used interchangeably. Etymologically, they come from the same basis. But if you think about which of the sutras did the Buddha write down, because that would be the most authentic. Do you know which one was the one the Buddha wrote? Oh, slandering. No, no. The Buddha didn't write any of the sutras. What? Well, who wrote them? Ananda wrote them, right? Ananda didn't write them. Let's see, Mahakashyapa must have wrote them. No?
Second Buddhist Council.
Second Buddhist Council wrote them. They didn't even write them. They put them on disk. They're on disk and they're in a cave that nobody's found somewhere in India. And when you find it, you're going to find these cool little disks and you're going to hear the Buddha. But he won't start his sutras. Sure, one. He won't start a sutra, thus I've heard, right? Hey, how can the sutra start, thus I've heard? Why don't they say, thus the Buddha spoke, or thus the Buddha wrote? Because he didn't write. No, he's writing away, this little guy's writing, but the Buddha himself didn't write. Why didn't the Buddha write? He dropped off. He was a drop-off. Well, literally, he was a drop-off. He really dropped out. If you're going to drop out, you're going to really drop out. Then you can drop in. But you know, you can't do it. Just dropping out of school is not dropping out. He didn't drop out. He was very well read. He was very well educated, obviously coming from the Kshatriya class and being a prince. He was very well schooled. He could write, but he didn't write. This is interesting. Not only he didn't write, but his disciples didn't write anything either. Nothing was written for how long? You know, 300 to 400 years after the Buddha passes. Only then do we get writing. Wow. You think about that. 300, that's longer than America's been in existence. The reason he did this, I think, was because of this finger pointing to the moon principle. If you write it down, it becomes hard and fast, and the context and the fluidity and the dialogue is lost. And it becomes dogma rather than therapy, to use this word. Rather than something that releases the immediate bonds that somebody's facing, it becomes stale and dead. Just like medicine stored for too long loses its potency. You know, especially if you're into Chinese medicine. Now, Western medicine has expiration dates, right? Everything has expiration dates. If my sister comes to me and says, here's a bottle of milk from your great-grandmother. I saved it just for you. Oh, pop. Die. Because it's no longer fresh. So in Chinese medicine, the same thing. Those herbs have to be relatively fresh, and after a certain amount of time, they don't have potency anymore. The teaching, like medicine, is meant to be dispensed according to an illness at a time. And then the Buddha says, once it releases your bonds, once you have understanding, there's no more need for the medicine and you move on. But by writing it down, then people have these actual rigid stories that may or may not apply to another situation. You see, and so actually the tradition was kept oral for 300 to 400 years before it was actually written down. And in the living tradition, you are encouraged not to lose this in the teaching. Not to lose the dialogical back and forth. Not to lose conditions and responding and changing to conditions and not making this some dead word that's carved on rock, but rather some living medicine that's meant to activate and reactivate your inherent wisdom. So we have to remember this. The teachings themselves are fingers pointing to the moon. This is a medicine kit. And the interesting thing about this passage is you see this as when you read the Bodhisattva learning all this, it seems as if it's a kind of advanced study, almost like learning to be a doctor. He's learning all the marks, all the fruits, all the appearances, all the conditions, all the potentials of living beings, and so on and so forth. He or she is mastering this in order then to be able to go out and expediently give the appropriate dharma for the appropriate obstruction. No obstruction, no dharma. The dharma only rises because of confusion. If there's no confusion, there's no need for dharma. I'm not making this up. It might sound irreligious. But the dharma only exists because there's confusion and attachment and suffering. And so the Buddha puts a counteractive device called dharma to release that. That's the only point and purpose of dharma. And the only point of practice is because we get lost and confused. Practice helps us reorient. But if we didn't get lost and confused, we wouldn't have to practice. This is how the teaching works. Okay, so it says he's good, knowing the most supreme wisdom for each drama, knowing the irreversibility, non-retreating. In other words, how do you get people, once you've led them along, to stay solid and not backslide? Backslide. Anybody know what that means? I made a vow that I was going to be a vegetarian this year, and it lasted 2 weeks. I reversed. I made a vow that I wasn't going to get angry at my husband anymore, and he made me break my vow. Reverse, right? I made a vow that I was going to teach and transform all living beings, but maybe next year, mañana, sempre mañana. This kind of irreversibility. Sometimes irreversibility occurs so fast. I'm taking refuge with the triple jewel. Oh, could I take it with 2 jewels instead of 3? No, 2 jewels. Okay, and then I'm going to take the Panchasila, the 5 precepts. I'm killing, stealing, searching, this kind of land. How about 4? I mean, even before you take them, you're already going in reverse. Well, maybe 3. This one's going to be tough, too. Let's see. How about if I start with just 1? This is called irreversibility at the beginning. You don't even get off the starting line that way. So he knows how to bring living beings so they're firm and solid. They don't want to retreat. How does he do that? This is important. How do you make someone solid and firm? And not reverse.
You have to be the one.
You have to be there first. You have to be a model, that's for sure. But some people think you can make people go into this by fear. You can make them, if you go backwards or reverse, you fall into the hells and so on and so forth. It might work for a day or two, but it's not going to work long term. Where does irreversibility come from? It doesn't come from fear.
You make them want to do it.
How's it?
You make them want to do to follow the path.
Well, how do you make them want to follow the path?
Solution to the problem.
Ah, some solution to the problem. The taste of Dharma is like Buddha said, taste of honey. It's good at the beginning, it's good at the middle, and it's good at the end. In other words, it is the taste of freedom and insight and liberation that makes it irreversible. It's not fear, okay? And it's not even wanting to be number one. I don't want to go backwards because then she'll beat me. It's not even that. It is once you know the flavor of this teaching and once you experience the liberation and joy, and what's the first ground? The happiness. There is no other way you'll ever be happy again except by staying within that space and cultivating that. That is what leads one on. And so this is deepening and deepening joy and happiness and kindness and compassion. And the experience of that is a fullness. It's not a shriveled up emptiness. You're feeling the fullness of yourself, your real self, growing and growing. You're becoming fully human and then fully spiritual. And this is the most powerful thing for irreversibility. Freud was right. Why do people do bad things? Because of desire. Why do we make laws? Because people want to do bad things. If they didn't want to do bad things, we wouldn't need to have laws, right? In the same way, once you have the positive side of this, you don't have to exhort. You don't have to encourage. People naturally will return to this because it's right and true. In Buddhism, this is the only thing that draws. There's no conversion and no hype or anything you can do to, you know, sort of tease people or tantalize people to come and hear the Dharma. It doesn't work. But once you taste that joy, once you taste that liberation, once you get the insight, and once you experience the fullness of yourself, then you become irreversible. So this is really important to understand. Good at knowing how to purify and regulate the bodhisattva grounds, up to including, in turn, entering the ground of the thus come one. Here it's wu lai. Okay. In Sanskrit, what is it? What's the word? This is Chinese, wu lai. Anybody know the Sanskrit? Tathagata. Tathagata. Some people say, well, there's Tathagata Buddha. There isn't a Tathagata Buddha. Okay? You say, oh, I've been bowing to Tathagata Buddha for 10 years. And now, well, if you've been bowing to Siddhartha for 10 years, even if you were bowing to an ant, you'd get married. But Tathagata Buddha is not a Buddha, it's a title, it's one of the 10 titles of the Buddha. Bhagavan Tathagata means thus come one. It also means thus gone one. It just means someone who's arrived at the ultimate state, who's filled their highest spirituality. They have arrived this way. It also means they don't come and go anymore. Now, I'm not going to go into that because that's a riddle. But it means that they have ended the problem of birth and death. So thus come on to Tathagata means that. So up and to the highest ground, which if you see where the 10 grounds are going, they're going up to Buddhahood. Okay. Any questions on this? Okay, clear. Oh, I'll tell you, now I'll give you a little story. It's a parable. Okay, so this little story, I like this one. This is about, and you go back to the passage here, you see where he was good at knowing the obstructions, what obstructs the grounds and clearing away the obstructions and so forth. Okay, so this is the illustration of that. And this is one of those fingers pointing to the moon stories. So, a young wife fell sick. She just married, and she got sick. And the honeymoon wasn't even over. And she was about to die. And she told her husband, she said, I love you so much. I do not want to leave you. That's all good so far. And she says, so don't go from me to any other woman. Because I love you so much. If you do, I'll return as a ghost and cause you endless trouble. Greater wealth. I mean, this is really sweet. So the wife passes away, and the husband respected her last wish for about 3 months. But then he met another woman, and he fell in love with her. And they became engaged and were going to get married. Now, immediately after the engagement, what happened?
The ghost came.
The ghost came. And it came every night, and it blamed him and scolded him for not keeping his promise. And the ghost was really clever. This ghost, it's a she, told him exactly what had passed between himself and his new bride, his new sweetheart, that day. Oh, you went out to lunch. You had this for lunch, didn't you? You told her this. And he was just scared. And whenever he gave his fiance a present, the ghost would describe it in detail. Oh, you gave her that nice ring. Huh? You gave her that dress, that red dress. Well, you gave it da 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 da. She would even repeat their conversations word for word that they had. And he could not sleep anymore. It's happened every night. So someone advised him to go see this charm master who lived close to the village. So in despair, the poor man went to him for help. Ah, said the master, your former wife became a ghost, and she knows everything you do. Whatever you do or say, whatever you give your beloved sweetheart, she knows. She must be a very wise ghost. Really, you should admire such a ghost. So he's not, what am I to make of this? And so he says, but I'll tell you, you can sometimes bargain with ghosts. So the next time she appears, you can bargain with her. He says, what do you mean bargain with the ghost? Well, praise her for knowing so much. Tell her, wow, you're really smart. You're the smartest ghost I ever met. And you know so much that there's nothing that I can hide from you. Tell her this. But if she will answer you one question, you can break your promise, right, and get married. But if she can answer this, if she can answer this one question, you can break it. But if she answers the question, you cannot get married. You have to. So he's saying, what's the question? I ask her. Okay. The man said, take a large handful of soybeans and ask her how many beans you hold in your hand. Okay. He says, okay. So the next night the ghost appeared, and the man flattered her. Oh, you're really wise. You're a penetrating ghost. There's no one like you. No, 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 no. And you know everything. She says, indeed, I do know everything. So finally you realize this. I even know you went to see that charm master today. And the man says, well, since you know so much, tell me how many beans I hold in my hand. And there was no longer any ghost to answer the question. So that's the parable. So how did that work? She's obviously allergic to soy. How did it work?
I think the ghost was just in his mind.
The ghost was a figment of his imagination. It was his own haunting and guilt that he felt. Because he didn't know how many beans were in his hand, right? And since he didn't know, and when he realized she couldn't answer it, he knew, she only knows what I know. So the charm master is teaching him that each day wakes him up. Everything's made from mind alone. Yes, there probably are ghosts and spirits, but in this case, you've just manufactured one. And thus he was free. Of course, until you're married, you know. So that's the story on that level. These parables are really quite interesting, aren't they? Yeah. Let's read on.
佛子，菩萨无舍善知其上，持离诸离，其心不乱，如是等知，入地势力，无有妄觉，有此。
Disciples of the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, that merchant leader, is that way. He is good at knowing the marks of the grounds. Starting at the first ground, he gives rise to practice which is uninterrupted. He continues in that way until he enters the tenth ground without interruption. Due to the light of wisdom in these grounds, he accomplished the less complex higher wisdom. So in this passage, there's a little forward-looking here. What he's saying is, he's hinting at something. First of all, he's going to hint at something, a merchant leader. But he doesn't explain that. So this is kind of like an introductory paragraph to what follows. So one level he's saying he is like a merchant leader. In what way? That he knows the appearances or the characteristics of these grounds, but then he doesn't explain it. This is what we then call a parable or an analogy. Right? Disciples of the Buddha is that way, like a merchant leader. And then it says, he does this practice uninterrupted, and it sort of says it's, he's going to go through all the 10 grounds until he reaches the final stage of the Tathagata's light of wisdom. And again, light of wisdom is a metaphor. Light is used to that which is the opposite of dark. But also, I want to point out that in many cases the texts actually talk about light that is emitted from someone with wisdom. So, again, in reading these texts, we want to be careful not to just read them one way and say, oh, light is a metaphor, and it means the light that sheds the darkness, darkness wombing, wombing meaning without light, right, is ignorance, and ming is light, and this is poetic metaphorical language. And many religious traditions talk about light as being the elevated element of spiritual understanding and insight and so forth, luminate and so forth. But we also want to understand there's another level to these texts that talk about light as not just metaphorical but real. That when the Buddha enters a state, he emits a light from the midst of his brows, and that light goes out and radiates and fills the hearts and minds of his disciples. This is talking about real spiritual light. This is not talking about metaphor anymore. Okay? Some of the people who attain spiritual sight can see things, also see these lights. We represent them feebly in our images here as part of the icon. For example, you look at the picture in the back wall, you'll notice that there's a Buddha sitting in meditation posture, and then what's behind his head? What's the... Yeah, it's a halo, or it's a light. It's a light that's radiant. This is how it's represented in art. But in reality, in the Buddhist time, as well as even into the current time, many people who encounter true cultivators, encounter sages, actually report seeing these lights, seeing these radiance coming off their beings and their body, and feeling the radiance coming to them and filling them. So I'm not going to go into this scientifically, it's very interesting. All I'm saying is, see it at all these dimensions. Don't just see it as metaphor. And some of you have had these experiences where you've gone someplace and you've actually experienced this effulgence of light. And it's not just a feeling, but an actual tangible experience you have. Yes?
The light is emerging and involving and penetrating, and one subjectively sees the light, but that doesn't necessarily mean, I think you're saying, it's not, it, 4,000 to 7,000 angstroms, electromagnetic wavelengths. It doesn't mean it's that, but it is perceived in that way.
And there may be, in fact, a way of measuring it. But I would hesitate to say that the way we have of measuring it now is the proper measure of it. Right. People talk about capturing this on cameras and so on and so forth. And to some extent, they do get some kinds of results that are interesting, but I'm not saying that's not what's going on. Between the viewer and the view, there is a state that arises. In other words, I mean, to say there's intersubjectivity involved here. It's not just one-dimensional. You have to be of a particular state in order to pick up on this. To see this light, you yourself have to be in a state that can receive this kind of thing. How this works is inconceivable. But I don't think it's beyond science. However, I don't think science is there yet. So there will be at some point, perhaps, a way that we can explain this. But our science is going to have to expand beyond its myopic study of phenomena that it's in now. We have reports of this. We have more reports of this. And we have all the evidence we need to say that. But the method to explain it is sort of like quantum physics. People can duplicate quantum phenomena, but there's no theory to explain how this is working. So in the same way we have these stories out of the histories of Buddhist monks and nuns and so forth, report this phenomenon. And they have a way of explaining it. This is the light of wisdom that comes to a pure heart and so on and so forth. But we haven't translated that into a sort of what we would call empirical science. But I think the problem isn't that the can't be done, is that the techniques or the tools that we use of science are rather dull and blunted instruments at this point and don't have the sensitivity to pick up on that. And as the sensitivity grows, there may be an approximation of that, but I don't think it's ever going to be the direct scene unless you are directly in that state to perceive it.
Yeah, some philosopher Schopenhauer said that all we can see is the phenomena, the noumena, actually what is going on, we can never see it. It's causal and it doesn't have a number. and all we can see is the phenomena, no matter how sharp our instruments are. So maybe when you see the light, that is actually a noumena.
These kinds of states in Buddhism, my teacher never presented as unusual or extraordinary. He says this is all very ordinary and very normal. The problem is, most of us, he said, are so asleep, we never catch it. And so, but this mirrors a passage from the Sutra in 42 sections where one of the disciples said, how can I know my past lives? That's what he was interested in acquiring. And the Buddha said, simply purify your mind and heart. And then even if you don't want to know, you will see them as clearly as you observe a piece of fruit in your hand. But unless you purify your mind and heart, this seeing will never be available to you because, in a sense, the eyes that see this are covered over by impediment. So again, in the presentation of this, these kinds of states, and you see this in this text all the time, the emission and illumination of light and so forth, this is not just metaphorical. This is real. But it only happens when one is pure. When one is pure. So the purification of oneself is the gateway to this scene. In a sense, you could say it's like me saying, I can't see how many men and women are here tonight. And then I do, oh, wow, look at that. There's da 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 da. This is a metaphor for clarifying your innate vision so that you can see things as they really are. In the same way, cultivating precepts, concentration, leads to a scene that is very natural then. But it's not like you have to do some exercise externally or you have to have somebody give it to you, but rather you just take the coverings off yourself and it becomes manifest. And so that is the same. When not even a single false thought stirs in you, the entirety of the everything becomes manifest. The entire substance manifest is the Chinese. Okay? The Taoists have an expression, to a still mind, the universe surrenders. To a still mind, the universe surrenders. You want to know all phenomena and the deepest truth behind it? Calm and still your mind so you can reflect. To that still mind, everything becomes manifest. So it's a different kind of knowing, a different kind of inquiry. That's why I don't think science is ready to get at it yet. Okay. I digress. Oh, boy. Okay, let's do one more passage here. Disciple of the Buddha, he is like a merchant leader who's skilled in expedient methods. When he's about to lead a group of merchants to visit a great city, before they set out, he first inquires about the merits and drawbacks of the route, the halting place of the longing, and whether it's safe or not. Afterwards, equipped with provisions on the road, judgment needs to be done. Okay, so now, as I said, the prelude was there. Now we're going to unpack the first part, which is the it is like, he is like, pyu, right? That's, in English you say it's like or as. These are words that are used for similes or metaphors. Pyu is the Chinese. It is like. It's not the same as, but why is he using an analogy? What's the point of using an analogy? What's that?
People can understand.
People understand. What an analogy does, remember I said before, parable, the origin of that word is to throw down something along something else, so that you can take something that you know and familiar with and allow you to then make a bridge over to something you don't know and you're unfamiliar with. So often if the Buddha sees his disciples are getting lost and he's going on with abstraction after abstraction, he says, it's like this. And then everybody wakes up because he's saying something that they understand. It's like a child who is. It's like a merchant who is. And they understand this then. So, in this particular case, he uses the merchant as a metaphor. Now, some of us may not have the same resonance with this metaphor because merchant today means what? What? I couldn't hear you.
Wall Street,
right. He didn't say it was like a Wall Street broker.
Telegraph Avenue.
What's that?
Could be Telegraph Avenue.
Could be Telegraph Avenue. These merchants, you have to realize, were people of usually great standing. They were many things in one. They were lenders. They were advisors. They were investors. They were protectors. But more importantly, you have to remember that a lot of what merchants do is trade. Now, you want to trade something, just have FedEx and UPS pick it up and it takes it. Puts it on some boat and it's off to China, right? You can order it online. You don't need a merchant anymore, dude. And if you have goods that you want to sell, you just go to eBay. Put it up on eBay, put it in a box, somebody picks it up and takes it away. But in the past, without trains, without transportation and so forth, all of the trade was done on routes that moved from one place to another. And moving those goods meant you had to go with your goods, or you had to hire somebody to watch over those goods. Trusting somebody to watch over your goods from place to place wasn't such a reliable thing, so often you would have to go with your goods. Now, what was involved in going with your goods? You wanted to take silk in China and trade it in Iran, or trade it in Khotan, or present-day Turkmenistan or something. What would you do? You get all the silk together, then what? How would you transport it? Donkey or camels? You'd make a caravan. Okay? Now you'd think, okay, one caravan, that's not the way to go. Maybe we should group together. And so you get a bunch of people. Some were selling silk, some were selling tea, some were selling jade, some were selling food stocks, and so on and so forth, jewelry, and everybody would band together in a place, and they'd form this caravan, they'd load this all up, and there'd be a leader, one leader, and there was a lot of responsibility that this leader had to do. It wasn't like, okay, everybody's here, let's go. Where? Oh, desert ahead, Gobi Desert, what's that like? No, they had to think, they had a plan, they had to know the routes, and they had to know, who are we going to encounter in between? It's not going to be like McDonald's every 10 miles, you know, the rest stop. So, in between, say, Iran and China, what would you likely encounter?
Robbers.
Robbers and bandits, right? Other merchants of another kind. You would encounter weather conditions. You would encounter provisions for this. You're talking about months of travel. So you have to have food and water. And you have to know the season when to go and when not to go. And you better know how camels behave too. You know, I always think of camels, yeah, you just put them on, you lead them around. Camels are ornery critters. They're really ornery. They spit at you, and sometimes they're really stubborn, right? And they'll just run off. So you got all these things. And plus, and I'm telling you from the stories I've read, you're going to say, there's ghosts and goblins and spirits they run into too. Xuanzang reports this in his autobiography when he went through the Gobi. And the story I'm going to share with you tonight has this in it, this element. So all these things are involved. And then you better be able to control and subdue people. You get out 10 days, 20 days on the trip, and all of a sudden you run out of something and there's a little rebellion. You better have some zuda. You better have some gravitas to be able to subdue and keep things in order. And you have to hire then bodyguards and caravan guards, right? You say, well, why don't you just take a Breem's truck? Well, that's the equivalent. You see money being transported now. Do you see it out on camels along Highway 101? You know, Bank of America, these bags over the side, and people going, no. You see this truck that just looks impenetrable. That's the modern caravan protector. So in the past, what they had to do, their armor was in the persons they hired. Well, who do you hire? You know, hiring guards for caravans is not as easy as it sounds. You know, you go around to sort of the martial gathering. Who are you going to pick out? Oh, yeah, you can trust me. I'll guard your stuff. We know this. There's no honor among thieves and so forth. One of my Kung Fu teachers was a caravan guard in the late 1920s in China along the Silk Route. And he had stories to tell about what that was like. It'd make your hair stand up on that, about what it was like to be a caravan guard taking these caravans. So we're talking about the Silk Road. We do know that in the present day, they still have ruins about every 30 miles in between. So there's little places where they actually had places to rest. You could park your camels there and get water. There was food. There was a place you could sleep and get out of the elements and so forth. And they scheduled them every 30 miles. Satellite photography, you can see. So an average day travel is about 30 miles if you're doing pretty well.
Denny's.
Yeah, sort of like a Denny's with a Marriott and so forth. But what's interesting too, along these routes, knowledge was exchanged. And Buddhism moved along the Silk Route from India into China, and then was through Central Asia, and many times it was conveyed back and forth, because one of the things you brought along in your caravan were monks. Either because this was the natural way for everybody to travel. So if you wanted to go from one place to the other, even if you weren't trading, this was a safe way to travel. It was like going in a group. So you had people who were just traveling along. But they also brought monks for other reasons. They felt that this would be good luck and bring protection against ghosts and spirits and bandits and robbers. So this is a very fast, and if you want to have some fun reading, you should go into these texts. Xuanzang's biography is particularly good because he talks about when they meet robbers. And one of the encounters they have, now I'm getting to my stories maybe, that's okay. One of the encounters that happens, they meet robbers, and the robbers steal their camels and all their possessions. And then they steal their clothes. So they're all naked. And at this point, they're all going, oh, woe is us, woe is us, woe is us. And Xuanzang is going, yeah, it's good, it's cool, everything's fine. And he said, how can you be happy? He said, they didn't steal the most precious thing. They said, what do you mean? They took their gold, silver, jade, everything. He says, we still have our lives. And they all went, whoa, yeah, this is the most precious thing. So they just went into the next town and got clothes. You have to imagine this, this group of people absolutely naked going, but happy because they still have their life. So bringing a monk along sometimes could turn tragedy into something like, hey, he's pretty good. So anyways, if you want to read that, it's called Journey to the Western Kingdoms. It's an actual full-length biography, autobiography. The one I know about is translated by Beal, B-E-A-L. I have a copy of it. But I remember I used to read this late into the night in the monastery, because it's just full of tale after tale after tale. encountering goblins and spirits and robbers and bandits and so forth. Anyhow. Oh, another part of this. So Shrentov does get to India on part of his, and he leaves illegally. The emperor doesn't want him to leave, but he sneaks out of the country and goes through this incredible journey to get to India. And of course, once he gets all the sutras and texts he wants, then he has to do the incredible journey. Now, he's a merchant leader because he has to bring the sutras back. And unfortunately, when you read his story, you realize not more than a few of the great sutras that we don't know about were lost on his return and never seen again. Because shortly after Xuanzang left and brought all this stuff out of China, there was an invasion of India, and many of the monasteries and the great library of Nalanda were burned, and these texts went up in smoke. So often, the original versions of texts that we have are only the ones that he was able, or Fa Xian and others were able to pull out before the great destruction of Buddhism during this time. But he reports, like crossing some of these streams, one or two of his donkeys that had sutras on just got washed away by the current. And that was it. He only had one copy. It wasn't like he had some Xerox machine he could just do copies and so forth. So a lot of the texts that he brought, quite a few of them never made it back to China. We don't know what those texts are. To this day, we don't know. They vanished. In any event, when he got there, I was telling some of this story the other day. There was a debate. He finally got to India. He went to Nalanda. He was studying Nalanda. And he was really smart. Sorry. Xuanzang mastered Sanskrit in a relatively short period of time. Now, to those of you who are studying Sanskrit, rest assured, Xuanzang himself said, this is tough. He says, Chinese is easy compared to this. And he thought Sanskrit was really hard, but he still applied himself. Did I tell you the story before he did that? He kind of met the Indian Tim Leary and... Okay. Well, we'll see. That we'll save that for another time. But he met an Indian Tim Leary who offered him the equivalent of LSD instead of... You know, but anyhow, so he goes to Nalanda and he studied, he mastered Sanskrit, and they think, this is really funny, this Jungurin, you know, this Weigelren, who's now mastering Sanskrit, let's have a debate and see how smart he is. So they have a great debate, and the Indians love debate. And Xuanzang gets up there, and he's debating in Sanskrit, not in Chinese. And goes from, you know, 100 down to 50 down to 20. Who wins? Xuanzang wins. And what does he get as a reward? He gets an elephant. And he gets the best nutmeg. And a kind of another food that, being from China, it was like, first of all, he didn't know what to do with the elephant. I was supposed to ride around on this elephant. And he didn't know what to do with the food because it wasn't Chinese food. So there he was with his rewards, but he didn't know what to do with them. Very funny. Anyhow, so this is the merchant thing. And I'm only going to be able to start our story tonight. And I'm afraid we'll have to wait till next week to finish it. But, okay. What got me going on this story, the merchants, was a nun came last night and gave me this book. It's a new book out for children called No Words, Teachings of the Buddha. Okay? And in this book, and it's wonderfully, it's illustrated by children. So it's not illustrated by a professional artist. And you'll see, like, here's the first picture. That's pretty cool, huh? Yeah, the one I like, yeah, let's see. Look at this one, isn't that neat? That's the elephant. Yeah, and this one is the mad elephant. Here's the story of the mustard seed. You know, this is a great, you know the story of the mustard seed, right? Let's see what we got here. All kinds of ones. Here's the one about a poisonous snake. And every illustration here is done by children. And in the back it has, you know, stories about how the children did this and whatnot. So this is a series of stories, parables, whatnot, for children. And she gave me this last night. It's just out. And I don't know, you can probably go to the website to figure out where you get copies of this. But these are basically stories for children. And so this reminded me of stories. And so I pulled out, and in here, many of these stories come from the Jatakas. Okay, you know the Jatakas, this is one of the divisions of the canon. And these are the stories of the Buddha's past lives. I've done this with you before. So tonight I'll start this. We only have 5 minutes left, so I'll just get you into this and then we'll finish it up next week. Because it's a rather long Jataka story. Okay? So relax. Kick back. We're going to have a Jataka. So this Jataka story is called the Apanaka Jataka. Apanaka Jataka. It's one of the early ones. And it says at one time the Buddha was dwelling at a great monastery in Jetavana, known Jetavana. What is Jetavana? The Jeta Grove, right? The Jeta Grove. And then it says, there was a treasurer who came with 500 disciples, 500 friends, and these were the disciples of all the other teachers around India at that time. These were non-Buddhists. But this treasurer brought these disciples of the other schools, and they went to them to the Jetavana, the Jeta Grove. When they came there, they brought offerings. What did they bring? And here's what the text says, garlands. What are garlands? Yes, strings of beautiful flowers, perfumes, various scented oils, unguents. What are unguents? Nobody knows unguents anymore?
Ointments.
Huh?
Ointments.
These are ointments. They're either used for medicine, as tinctures, or they're used for fragrances. But these are part of the things that are used both to adorn but also to cure, that you can use certain oils or onions to heal the body. And they had various kinds of oil. This isn't, you know, cooking oil or Wesson oil. This is, you know, special oil. Honey, molasses, various cloves and cloves. And after they bowed to the Buddha and made these offerings, the garlands and the like, and handed over to the Sangha and the medicinal oil and so forth with the cloths, then this was done. He took a seat to one side, that is this treasurer, and all the disciples likewise took their seats by the side of, now who's the treasurer? Anybody want to know who the treasurer of, this city is Sravasti, so who is the treasurer of the city of Sravasti at the time of the Buddha? This is your midterm. Anybody know who the treasurer of the city of Sravasti was at the time of the Buddha? Ananda Bindika. Ah. And he gazed at the appearance of the Buddha as glorious as a full moon, and upon his excellent presence endowed with all the marks and the characteristics of an enlightened being. And he viewed the light. He saw the light. And in that light, the marks and the appearance of the Buddha even radiated further, and a glory issued from, as if the garlands were imbued with the light and the light with the garlands, and it went on like this and on like this. This is what the text is describing. So now, who's Ananda Pindika? What does his name mean? Well, not really. It means benefactor. But he's benefactor of who in particular? Thus I heard at one time the Buddha dwelt the Jeta Grove together with the gathering of bhikshus, the garden of the benefactor of orphans and solitary. Now that's, orphans and solitary means what though? Widows or widowers and children without parents. So he was a benefactor who used his wealth to create a support system for people who were no longer being supported through family or jobs or whatnot. And that's where he applied himself. And he was the wealthy leader, the treasurer of Sravasti. Do you know how he met the Buddha? I mean, this is a really interesting story. And that's, we'll just start this tonight. He was wandering around Sravasti checking things out. And he saw somebody decorating this incredible house. And he said, why are you decorating your house so lavishly? And he said, because I've invited the Buddha to come here and talk. And before anything, when he heard Buddha, he just paused. He was struck with awe. It said his hair stood on end. He was so moved, just hearing the word Buddha. And he said, what is, who is Buddha? Because this is, and he explained, he was this prince, he left his home and family, went off and he cultivated this, and it says he's attained spiritual accomplishments, and now he teaches for the benefit of others. So he hears this teeth, and he goes, whoa, I got to meet this guy. And so, as the word goes, he is wandering around, and he, again, I'm going back to the light, he's wandering around at night, and the Buddha sees that he's very sincere, and the Buddha admits a light. And Ananda Pindika says, oh, gee, I thought it was night, but it's daytime. So he's just wandering around, and he says, and it's more bright over there, and he keeps following, and he ends up meeting the Buddha. And the Buddha says, oh, okay. And the Buddha begins to speak some shaping Dharma for him. And he's moved to tears, and he bows, and he's so happy. And after this, he doesn't want to leave the Buddha's side. He's so happy with what he hears. And then he says, you know, but that guy's house, that was a small place. I mean, look, you've got 1,250 disciples. And when word gets out, because I'm going to put the word out, there's going to be more coming. Because you see here, he brought 500 in already. And he says, I'd like to give you a big place. And the Buddha said, okay, could, if you want to. So he goes around and goes around, he's looking for a big place to give. And what does he find? The opinion of the equivalent of Central Park in New York. He says, I'll take that. There's no for sale sign. It's not like for lease or for rent. It's called the Jetha, Prince Jetha's garden. And it's not like our little garden. It's this huge estate with wonderful streams and flowery trees and all kinds of things. And he says, I want your garden. And Jetha says, excuse me? I want to buy your garden. And Prince Jetha doesn't want to part with it. So he gives him an offer. He thinks, there's no way he could ever come up with a response. What does he say to him?
We can use the gold.
If you can cover the whole of the garden with gold coins, you can have it. You know, and what does he do? He goes and cashes in a whole bunch of his wealth into gold coins. And he's in the garden, and Jetha's looking every day. He's going down, laying down these gold coins. He's like, oh, you know. He gets halfway, and he's going, well, huh. And pretty soon, he's done it. He's covered the whole garden with gold coins. And he said, well, I was just joking, man. It was just a figure of speech. And he says, you can't joke. You're a king, a prince. You know? You have to stand by your word. You can't do some spin now and get your, you know, spokesperson to come out and said, well, you really meant this, you know. So he said, okay. And it's for the Buddha, I understand the Buddha's great. So he said, okay, but you didn't cover the trees. And so Ananda Pindika goes back, no, I'm just joking. You don't have to cover the trees. The trees are mine, but I'll donate them too, because I want to get in on this gig that you're doing. So there it's called then the garden, the Jetha Grove and the Garden of the Benefactor of the Orphans and Solitary. There's a double billing. The Jetha Grove means the trees that belong to Prince Jetha, and the Garden of the Benefactor of the Orphans and Solitary, Ananda Pindika's garden. So it's Jetha, Ananda Pindika's place for the Buddha. So this is a story. And anyway, now I have to go into the rest of this, and we just don't have enough time tonight. So I'll pick it up next time. But essentially, this is the precursor to the actual story of the merchant. But the Buddha's explaining, when he brought these 500 disciples here to the grove, something happened. And what happened is the whole basis then for this story. Okay? And then, but we ran out of time, and I really don't want to keep you past there. So, next time, should we continue with the story?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do the story next time. Any questions or announcements? Yes?
I have two long questions.
A long question?
Two long questions.
Why don't we do one?
Well, I'll tell you the answer to one.
Oh.
That is talking about handing down this spiritual jewels. It seems like there's a mechanistic preference for least error to depend on the spiritual people to tell each other the right story and not interject their own opinion or leave out important stuff or something, that is more dependable than the variations of language. And that seems that is testable, except that it can't be tested on this whole stuff. I mean, you can test it on something else, but you know, you don't have the holy stuff to test it on. I mean, you already did that. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but one of the things to think about with the text and with the story is that these are catalysts. In other words, these aren't rigid, dharmic, dogmatic truths, but rather the measure of their authenticity, the measure of their truthfulness, is the effect that they have on the hearts and minds of the listeners. So something is rufa according with the Dharma if in hearing it you are feeling more kind, more compassionate, more understanding of yourself and others, less afflicted, less troubled, and more clear. Then this is the measure of its. It's not that the Buddha spoke it or didn't speak it, but it's rather it's measured by its orthopraxic effect, how it liberates, how it unties, how it frees up. This is the real measure of the teaching, and that's why, even within the teaching, it's not just the Buddha who speaks the Dharma. In fact, all different kinds of beings can speak the Dharma. And the measure of that is never in, oh, I don't know if the Buddha said it or the Buddha didn't say it, therefore it's authentic or not. The measure is, does this lead to compassion and wisdom? Does this lead to insight and understanding? Does this catalyze your spiritual? If it does, this is Dharma. So, again, getting the exact word of the stories is not quite as important as getting the spirit or the deeper intent behind these, which is to cause that liberation and insight.
So almost, it seems like a maturation or fermentation performance is actually a growth of the word.
Well, in fact, there is a division of the canon. There's 12 divisions of the canon, meaning the doctrinal teachings are handed down. Mm-hmm. And one division is called not yet spoken. And you're saying, wait a minute, that sounds very open-ended. That which has not yet been spoken. And what its meaning is, Dharma is emerging and evolving. So therefore, what the Buddha taught is still being taught and still emerging to emerging potentials and capacities of living beings. So this really helps you understand. In some traditions, the word is the word and it's fought over, and you're not going to add or subtract from it. In this tradition, the word is the finger pointing to the moon. Well, perhaps next time we'll use a stick to point to the moon. Or next time we'll use a laser to point to the moon. But where does it say laser in the text? It doesn't, but it's expedient to point to the moon. So again, there can be a category of teachings that has not yet been heard, not yet been spoken, that is emerging and evolving with changing conditions of living beings.
So it's like new wine.
It's like
new wine.
New, you could say it's new wine in old bottles, to use that expression.
Well, I don't mean the old bottles and testing stuff. I mean there's new wine. The new wine has to set. And it does come
right.
These things have to be spoken through generations, and they haven't gone through that process yet.
Better than wine, since people think it's time for no. the one we would use is think about medicine. Medicine cures illness, but the medicines we use to cure the illnesses of the medieval times or even last century are not the medicines we're using now. So if you say, oh, medicine's in this cabinet, it's fixed forever, all of a sudden you have a new virus coming up and you don't, where are you going to get the end? You have to come up with a new medicine to cure the illness. The principle of using the medicine to cure the illness is unchanging, it is eternal. This is the eternally dwelling Dharma. However, the specific form of that Dharma, that medicine, will change and adapt to the different illnesses and diseases that come up. So, that's why it's so important to understand that this is a living, breathing, evolving tradition, but it's based on eternal principles. So you can't say it's absolutist and you can't say it's relativistic. It's somewhere drawing on the best of both. It responds to conditions, but does not change. It does not change, yet is responsive to changing conditions. This is what the Dharma is. Therefore, for every generation, for every different person It has to be renewed. It has to be, there's a Chinese expression, I don't know, one of my Chinese professors used it, it has to be reheated. Reheated, in other words, it's like leftover, you have to reheat it, you have to reinvigorate it to make it respond. So that's why I think the Buddha resisted writing it down and codifying it. He gave the principles of how, and then he said, once you understand these principles, you can go out and generate this teaching again and again for all these different conditions. But if we just say it's this and written down, we limit it to a time and a place and a context that is only once, maybe. And so you have to get the spirit more than the letter, and then it can go on.
Is what you're saying about the unspoken words perhaps stuff that has been saved for our time, for us to process and send down? It hasn't been spoken yet because it was saved for this time.
No, it doesn't mean it's been hidden away until people are ready to hear it or receive it. What it means is Dharma is medicine to be given to cure illnesses. Therefore, Dharma must evolve to respond to the illnesses as they become more and more changed by the circumstances of time and place. That's what it means. And so what the wonderfulness of this is that yes, we have teachings and rely on them, and yet at the same time, we have to always remember they are rafts to bring about a result. And once the result is accomplished, it's served its purpose. If it's not working, then you have to change to a different medicine. You have to bring something that cures the illness. This is what the Buddha said, my teaching is only for one thing, to bring an end to dukkha, to bring an end to suffering. Once suffering is ended, you can dispense with this. So wherever there's suffering, you respond with a counteractive, and that is Dharma. Okay? This is so important that the Buddha even said in one of the famous texts, this is the Lankavatara Sutra, he said the teaching, the Dharma, that is not given for this and that, for this person and that circumstance, is not a teaching. This is very important to understand. You can't say, oh, the Buddha said. That is not a teaching unless it's meant for this or that, that it's actually responding. Otherwise, it's not a teaching. So you can't use Dharma like a hammer to hit people over the head and say, the Buddha said, the Buddha said, the Buddha said. You have to use it for the time and the context of the situation, and then it's a teaching.
It's ointment.
It's ointment, it's medicine, it's all of that. It's not wine. Okay. So let's do the transference. Oh, I'm sorry, were there some announcements? Tomorrow morning, we have our two-hour meditation sit with a discussion. So if people are interested in sitting, we have two consecutive sits, about 45, 50 minutes, and then we have a little discussion, question and answer with tea, 8:30 to 10:30 tomorrow morning. Anything else? Do you have an announcement?
No?
Okay. If people want to get this, sure. This is the book. Actually, this was done by one of the nuns at the city. And yeah, I saw the picture of the kids in the back who did the artwork. So this is a labor of many efforts and wonderful. Has he read it yet? You should bring it and let him read it during, because he's not following my lecture. He's totally bored. Okay, let's do the transference.
Amen. 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 Am
found as light, break the darkness of their endless night. Because our hearts are one, this world of pain turns into paradise. May all become compassionate and wise. May all become compassionate.
In the sunbelt.